This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
A best of Radio EcoShock replay.
You know, for example, temperature changes from Miami to Montreal, kind of temperature changes occurring in a matter of 20 years, 50 years, something like that. In some cases, even faster than that.
The public still does not know that sudden and major climate changes have occurred in the past and could be written into our future. Ice records from Greenland show things like a doubling of snowfall in 2 years or less. There were periods where the temperature went up 1 degree centigrade every year for 5 years. That's 100 times faster than our current warming. It's called abrupt climate change. That was the topic of the Nye Lecture given at the meeting of the American Geophysical Union last December 2014. The speaker was Dr. James White, a professor of geological sciences at the University of Colorado in Boulder. He's also the director of INSTAR, the Institute of Arctic and Alpine Research at the University of Colorado. Jim White, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I'd like to help spread some of the startling news you delivered at the Nye Lecture. First of all, what do you mean by abrupt climate change?
Well, what we mean by abrupt climate change is a change that's faster than we're capable of dealing with. And that's sort of the simple, kind of, you know, straightforward definition. We can give you scientific definitions that have to do with time and magnitude. But really, we're talking about things that we're not capable of dealing with either economically or socially, that happen too fast and are too big for us to handle.
And certainly it should happen within one lifetime, you say.
Yes. You know, there's some time frames and size frames that we can place on this. Within a lifetime, or ideally, not ideally, but most of these changes occur in a matter of a few years. So they are of a magnitude that, you know, for example, temperature changes from Miami to Montreal, kind of temperature changes occurring in a matter of 20 years, 50 years, something like that. In some cases, even faster than that. So these are big enough to be very noticeable and fast enough that it would be a shock to the system. It's safe to say we've not seen anything like that in the last several hundred years of recorded history.
Well, the people of Montreal might be happy with it, but I think chaos would resume if that happened. So you say we're concerned not just with abrupt climate change, but also abrupt impacts on human systems. Could you give us an example of that?
Yeah, it's important to recognize that a slowly changing environmental system, like a slowly changing temperature, could tip our systems over thresholds. I'll give you a couple examples. One is when large companies like Google and Microsoft have these big server farms, these big computer server farms, they have to have very expensive and sophisticated air conditioning because there's a lot of heat produced when these computers are turned on. If you're going to buy tens of millions of dollars worth of air conditioning, you want it to last for the full time period that it's supposed to last, which is about 30 years. If climate is changing slowly, then it's possible that this very expensive air conditioning system you bought isn't going to last 30 years, and it may fail after 15 years. That 15 years doesn't sound abrupt, but to a company that spent tens of millions of dollars on this piece of equipment, that is an abrupt impact. And it is a very undesirable impact because they will lose a lot of money because they did not consider that a slowly changing baseline, in this case temperature, would push a system that they purchased out of its ability. Another example, another very clear example, is the threshold height of the New York City subway system. There were many, many storms over the last 50 years that pushed a lot of water up towards Manhattan. And it wasn't until Sandy came along that extra 6 inches or so that was needed to hit the height of the subway system threshold was reached. And when that happened, a billions and billions of dollars type of problem became a multi-billion dollar type of problem because water was able to pour into the subway system and into the tunnels. So that is a very physical, obvious threshold that we have in our system. And in that particular case, it has to do with storm surges and sea level rise and things like that.
And I found a key teaching moment about tipping points in your story about the Niagara River. Please tell us about that.
Well, it's important to recognize that not all tipping points are going to be obvious. And it's entirely possible for us to pass them without really knowing about it. And the analogy I use is, suppose you are an explorer on the Niagara River. You don't know it's a Niagara River. All you know is it's a river, and you are canoeing down. And if you're prudent, you will stay near the shore because you don't quite know what's ahead on any river, any unexplored river. But if you're in a hurry, and the Niagara River flows pretty swiftly, you get out in the middle of the river and you paddle along. As you're paddling along out in the middle of the river, you hear a roar. You're not quite sure what it is. And then by the time you realize that, hey, there could be trouble up ahead, it's too late. You cannot get to the shore in time. The current is too swift. And in that particular case, you passed a tipping point before you ever went over the falls. You are not going to survive the fall over the falls. And, you know, sadly, you are, you're just as dead minutes before you go over the falls as you are at, when you go over the falls. And so this is an example of a tipping point that you really wanted to be prudent. You wanted to be cautious. You want to take some care and give yourself every opportunity to avoid that tipping point. And if you're not prudent, if you're not cautious, if you're out in the middle of the river, you may find yourself going over the falls without any recourse.
So let's look at what we know about abrupt climate change in the past. Can you give us sort of a nutshell of what science has discovered?
Yeah, our planet is capable of some very remarkable changes in climate. If you look at the ice core record, which is what I work on, you'll see changes of temperature of 10 to 15 degrees Celsius mean annual temperatures that happen in a matter of anywhere from a few years to 30, 40, 50 years. The rate of change of temperature today is about 1 degree C in 100 years, and we are very interested in that, and we're very nervous, if you will, about what this might mean. If you look at abrupt changes, you're looking at changes of a degree in 10 years, or a degree per year, which is 100 times faster. And there are even changes where you get 10 degrees in a year, which is 1,000 times faster. So these are changes that would be very, very obvious. I tell my students, imagine if you enrolled at a, you know, in a college with an environment like in the southeastern United States, and by the time you graduate, you were in a climate of Minneapolis. That's the kind of change that would occur over that 4 or 5 years that it takes you to get through college. And obviously, we've not seen anything like that in the last couple hundred years, but nature tells us that our climate system is capable of these sorts of changes, and many of them have indeed occurred.
Well, this brings out two questions in my mind. First of all, how certain are we about the information in the ice cores?
Well, the information in ice cores is quite good. We have measurements of temperature changes by a number of different methods. We don't just rely on one or two. We can actually see annual layers in ice cores, even going back 20,000 years. And I think the other important key is that we see these changes not just in one ice core. We see them in all ice cores. And we see them in different degree from, say, southern Greenland to northern Greenland in a way that makes sense from a climatological point of view. We tend to see them less in southern Greenland where it's closer to the ocean and more in northern Greenland where it's farther away from the ocean. So replication of cores, replication of different ways of reconstructing the information. We're quite careful. And I would point out that when we first started to study these things, those of us who looked at them were just as doubtful of their reality as any normal human being would be. And it took us a couple of ice cores, two or three as a matter of fact, before we began to accept that these things were real and to study them in the kind of detail that we have now.
Now, my second question is, all right, we realize the temperatures in northern Greenland, say, went up 1 or 2 degrees in just 1 or 2 years, but what does that tell us about the whole planet? The Arctic is warming rapidly right now, but the global mean temperature is only going up slowly. Do abrupt changes in the Arctic really apply to the rest of us?
Great question, and it is the limitation that ice cores have, particularly in Greenland and Antarctica. You're seeing polar changes, and you're right. The amplification in the poles is going to be on the order of a factor of 3 or so. So if you see a 10-degree change in polar regions, that's probably in the neighborhood of a 3-degree change in at least hemispheric temperature. Maybe even global temperature. So there are many, many things we can do to kind of attack this problem. One is to look for these same kind of changes in ocean sediments, which are distributed around the world. We can also look for these changes in Antarctica and try to and also look for the changes in cores that we see in mountainous regions like Tibet and the Andes, etc., to try to get a more global picture of what's going on. The changes I was talking about, particularly during the Ice Age, we see them all over the Northern Hemisphere. We see them in the coastal waters off of California. We see them in the waters off of Brazil. We see them all over the Atlantic and the Pacific. So these were hemispheric-wide changes. Interestingly, not very well expressed in the Southern Hemisphere, which is a big, as you know, a water hemisphere and less of a water and land hemisphere. So there are ways that we can try to look at the spatial distribution of these things.
All right. Now, they happened in past ages. Are there abrupt changes happening now?
There are abrupt changes happening now, and I think it's an important piece of information for I think, all of us to understand. Today, there are a number of abrupt changes. The ones that are very visible, one is the disappearance of sea ice in the summertime in the Arctic. There are some wonderful visualizations that you can get from NASA and from NOAA that show sea ice, not only in its extent, but very importantly, in its thickness over the last 20 years or so. And in that short period of time, 20 years or so, summertime sea ice has changed dramatically in the Arctic. It is now, it's gone from what used to be multi-year ice, which would be meters and meters thick and capable of handling a warm summer, to vast areas of the Arctic Ocean are now one-year ice, which is thinner. And for any of us who's lived in areas where ice melts in the springtime, you know that a really warm summer with the right wind conditions can remove that ice. And the reason why that is important is that the reflectivity of the planet, how much white stuff there is reflecting the sun's incoming energy, is extremely important to climate. And when you replace white reflective ice with blue ocean, you change dramatically the amount of energy in the Arctic. Other examples of abrupt change going on today, we're in the midst of one of the great species extinctions that the planet has seen. And this one is one that we human beings are the root cause of in terms of changing habitat, removing habitat, changing climate. So there are a number of ways in which we are causing abrupt changes today.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Dr. James White from the Institute of Arctic and Alpine Research at the University of Colorado, and we are talking about abrupt climate change. Now, Dr. White, in your talk at the AGU, you spent a lot of time talking about sea level rise. Why?
Well, the reason has to do with how certain we are that sea level rise not only is occurring, but will continue to occur. I think one of the things I hear back when I talk about the subject of climate change in public is people want to know, what are the things I can rely on? What are the things that are actually going to happen? And what are the things that we're not so sure about? You know, how do we, because our models are very good, but they're not great. So sea level rises for two simple physical reasons. One is that as air warms, water warms, and as water warms, it expands. The other thing that happens is warmer air and warmer water melt land ice and put that ice into the ocean. Those are both very simple, very straightforward physical realities. And if you look at the history of the planet over the last million years, as temperature cools, land ice grows. As temperature warm, land ice shrinks back into the ocean. And these are very faithful relationships. We now know on our planet, if it's going to be a warm planet, you're going to have high sea level. If it's going to be a cold planet, you're going to have lower sea level. So that kind of certainty is really important. And the other piece of this is the sea level doesn't change by inches. Sea level changes by hundreds of feet on the planet. And that's a hard lesson for many people to grasp, I think, because we're kind of used to sea level being level. But changes of 10, 20 feet in sea level is really nothing for the planet. 400 feet is the change that has occurred over the last million years, and 20 feet is really a small amount of that. 20 feet, on the other hand, is a huge impact for a city like Norfolk, Virginia, or Washington, D.C., or Miami, or Oakland, California. And so the impact of sea level on us, sea level change on us, is something that we're going to have to get used to and have to deal with.
And I presume, though, that it still wouldn't be necessarily an abrupt change. It might take thousands of years to reach 20 meters higher than today.
Well, it would probably take hundreds of years. But what's important to understand is that Niagara analogy. We don't know how irreversible some of the sea level rise is that's going on today. An example of that is the West Antarctic Ice Sheet. That's the smaller piece of that Antarctic Ice Sheet. When you Google and look at Antarctica, it's that lobe. There's about 6 meters, so, you know, 20 feet or so of sea level rise in West Antarctica. And West Antarctica, like other bits and pieces of Antarctica and Greenland, is its base is well below sea level, in places hundreds to thousands of feet below sea level. And so this is what we call a marine-based ice sheet, and these are inherently unstable ice sheets. When they start to melt, you can imagine this big chunk of ice, it loses its what we call pinning point or grounding line. It begins to flow, and there's really nothing to stop that ice from flowing into the ocean. And it's really just a matter of physics. How rapidly can that ice flow? And it's not going to reverse itself very easily. It's not going to suddenly stop again and then reform as an ice sheet. So there's a certain irreversibleness of ice sheet behavior that we are beginning to try to understand, and we're nervous about that, quite frankly.
Right. Well, you know, I've also heard you say in video that the methane threat is not that great, and that's despite the findings, as you say, by scientists that in the past methane went up as much as 50% in a lifetime. What are your thoughts about the work of Natalia Shakova and her Russian counterparts warning about abrupt climate change driven by big increases in methane coming from shallow seabeds in the Arctic?
Well, our committee, the National Academy Committee, took a hard look at methane. And I think there's sort of two messages to get out there. One is there is as much carbon locked up in permafrost as there is in all coal, oil, and natural gas. And that permafrost is melting. And it is going to be a very large and very difficult positive feedback on the warming of the planet that we're causing by burning fossil fuels. The question is whether or not it's going to be abrupt. And when the committee began to look at this, there are good physical reasons for expecting that carbon to come out slowly rather than abruptly. And that's good news in the sense that we probably won't see large increases in methane in short periods of time. The bad news, obviously, is that once these systems start to melt and continue to melt, then that carbon still comes out. And you can imagine, you know, all the efforts that we put into managing carbon or having carbon trading agreements or putting a price on carbon. If nature gets into the game and begins to put as much carbon in the atmosphere as we do, it makes it very difficult for us to deal with that. So I don't want to minimize permafrost and what we call methane class rates as a really difficult part of the positive feedbacks that we're going to see. The question is whether or not it's going to be abrupt.
All right. Now, I'd like to get in another key quote from your lecture, and that is this one. When one generation is not willing to set aside short-term profits to deal with the benefit of their children, you're never going to solve this problem because we live on a water planet. Can you explain that?
Yeah, I think what I tried to do in that lecture was, I think, tie back the simple physics of our planet to constraints that we face as human beings. It's no secret, you can look at the Earth from outer space, it's 70% water at its surface. Water takes a long time to warm up, and it takes a long time to cool off. And, you know, I tell my students, or when I give public lectures, put two pots of water on the stove. Put one with water in it and one without water in it. Turn the heat on identically. Go away for a couple minutes, come back, put your finger in the water. It's not going to be very warm. Put your finger in the other pot, and this is a thought experiment, folks. That sizzling sound you hear is the tip of your finger. Energy is neither created nor destroyed. That's another physical principle. So why is it the pot without water is very hot and the pot with water is not? And the answer has to do with the water's ability to absorb heat. The heat capacity of water is very high. What's happening today on our planet is that extra greenhouse gases are accumulating energy in the atmosphere, and most of that energy, 90-something percent of it, is going to warm up the ocean. What that means is there's always a delay between what we call the climate that CO2 would like to have. We have 400 parts per million CO2. That climate is very, very warm, but we don't have a 400 part per million CO2 climate yet. That won't come until the ocean warms up, which is 50 or 100 years down the road. So until one generation says, you know, I shouldn't have put all that CO2 in the atmosphere, you're never going to be able to deal with this problem. You're always going to be passing the climate problem on to the next generation. And that's a real key constraint, if you will, because we live on a water planet.
All right, now we're starting to run out of time, but I wanted to note that you did end your Nye lecture with three things that we need to do to prevent a climate catastrophe. Could you just list those out for us?
Yeah, as I've studied this problem, I'm a scientist, a physical scientist, but as I've studied this problem, I've begun to realize that the ethical side of the equation, the value side, is probably going to be the key to understanding how we're going to move forward. So I just gave you one, what I think is a very important value issue, and that is intergenerational issues. So I'm a father and a grandfather. I think it's very important. I want to see my kids have a great life. I want to see them have a better life than I have. That won't happen unless my generation thinks seriously about climate change. So growing up, in a sense, and actually valuing our kids in practice as much as we say in words is important. That's one value issue. A second value issue has to do with population. Population is one of the underpinning problems that we face today. We have 7 billion people and growing. As it turns out, the number one way in which population can be controlled on our planet is valuing women. So when women have value economically and politically, they have fewer children per woman. We live on a very male-dominated planet in a very male-dominated world, and that creates problems for us. And as I say to all my fellow males, you know what? Share some power, because it's going to be good for you. It's going to be good for the planet. The other message that I gave in that lecture was, we live in a world today where about 2 billion people simply can't afford to care about the environment. They're too poor. They're too worried about where they're going to get their next meal. They're too worried about their kids having shelter and food. Unless we have a world in which there's a minimum sort of economic base that people are comfortable enough that they can care about the environment, you're never really going to solve these environmental problems. They're going to burn coal. They're going to burn whatever they can. So you've got to think about wealth equity as well. So valuing our kids, gender equity, wealth equity, these are things that we need to do to move forward. And I think they are things that move us forward as a species as well. And so to me, this is very good news. Very good news that we need to be better people in order to be more sustainable.
I agree. That is good news. And I think we'll have to hope for an abrupt change in human readiness to deal with this mega problem, and those good things will happen with it. We've been listening to Dr. James White. He's the director of the Institute of Arctic and Alpine Research at the University of Colorado. There's lots of videos with James White, and I'll put links to some of them in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Right now, unfortunately, Jim's 2014 Nye lecture is not freely available to the public. I have a recording of the talk, and I'll make some inquiries to see if anyone objects to posting that in my blog. I don't know. Jim, do you think I would have your permission, and do I need to ask the AGU if I can get that audio out there?
You need to ask the AGU, and you certainly have my permission. I would love to see it freely available.
All right, I'll check on that. If we can do it, it will be in my blog next week. Dr. James White, thank you for spreading science out to the public and for talking with us on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Despite the winter cold covering North America, the year 2014 was probably the hottest ever recorded. It's another milestone in the road to extreme climate change. But maybe you've noticed the resistance. Friends, family, or workmates don't want to talk about it. You know the science and the truth about warming, and you're stuck with it. Are we alone with this awful knowledge? Back in 2013, we heard from Rosemary, or Ro Randall. She's the UK psychotherapist that co-founded Carbon Conversations. That's the place where circles of people meet to talk about climate change. It's time to connect again. Ro Randall, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
I'm pleased to be with you, Alex.
Always great to talk with you. So why don't we remind listeners how Carbon Conversations work? Can you give us an outline of the program?
Carbon Conversations consists of small groups of 6 to 8 people who meet around 6 times over a period of about 3 months to talk about climate change and carbon reduction. They meet with 2 trained facilitators, and they use some specially prepared materials which take people through all the different elements of how, as individuals, we have an impact on the climate and what we can do about changing that. And the groups provide a safe place. I think this is very important. It's a place where people can feel free to speak without fear that they're going to be judged and without fear that they're going to be pressured into doing something which they maybe don't feel able to manage. One of the things which characterizes our relationship to climate change is that it is in the long term going to require us to make big changes in how we live our lives, and that people very often react to that with very complex mixes of feelings. It makes people feel anxious, ashamed, guilty, angry, uncertain, despairing sometimes. And so it's very important that when people begin to try to understand what it is that's going on, what has gone on and what has to happen next, that they're able to do so in a place where they can work out what they feel about this, they can work out what their own views on it are, what their ideas are, and with the support of others, come to some decisions that feel right to them. And, of course, people also need quite a bit of information in order to be able to do that. I was having a conversation just the other day with a really lovely young woman. She'd just flown in from the States, in fact, and she was telling me about how she discovered that by using a particular font when you typed, you could use a lot less ink, and this was going to be a really good thing for climate change. And this was a very sweet statement, but, of course, any savings that she might make by using a different font would be dwarfed by the flight that she'd just taken. And very often people don't understand how important certain things are and how small perhaps other things are in this big picture. So finding ways to give people reliable information is also really, really important.
So now, almost a couple of years since we last talked, what's new?
Well, what's new is that we have taken a really good look at everything we've been doing. We've absorbed a lot of feedback from people about the way that we have presented the materials and the way that we run the groups. And we've come up with a brand new book, which is called In Time for Tomorrow, the Carbon Conversations Handbook, a new workbook, some new online materials, a new guide to facilitating the groups. And we're about to launch that in January this year, January the 14th. And the big difference is that whereas before, in order to get your hands on any of these materials, you had to sign up and join a group. The book, In Time for Tomorrow, is now available to the public. You can buy it by going to the Carbon Conversations website. And we're hoping that by reading the book, more people are going to feel drawn into taking part. And we've also put a lot of new material into the book. One of the things which people told us was that they wished there was more in the book about the psychological dilemmas that people go through when they're in the groups. Because originally we thought, well, that's experiential stuff. As a psychotherapist, I often feel that telling people stuff doesn't really change very much. You've got to experience it. And so we haven't put in a lot of detail about the anxiety, the guilt, the sense of loss, the way people get stuck when they try to reduce their footprint. And this time around we have. We've put a lot more new material in on that. We've also created a whole new chapter which is called Talking with Friends, Family and Colleagues. And this is about the point which you raised in your introduction, which is about what do you do if you yourself are concerned, but when you start to raise it at the dinner table with friends or somebody's chatting around the water cooler at work, you meet a kind of wall of indifference and you can find yourself seen as the oddball, the odd one out, the one who's always making everybody else feel bad. And so this time around, we're trying to deal head on with some of those experiences as well.
Yeah, it really isn't easy. You bring up climate change and a friendly conversation can drop with a dull thud, and that leaves us feeling exposed. How do we handle that?
I think one thing is to start to think strategically about when you want to talk about climate change and when you don't. So that when the conversation at work is just around, oh, I flew here, I flew there, I've bought a new car, I've bought this new stuff, these may be times to stay quiet, and unless you're sure that you can bring in your own point of view without being seen as attacking somebody else. And often it's better to look for your own opportunities and to think about, well, who do I actually want to talk to about this? And in what kind of context do I want to raise this? So if it's a situation at work, for instance, you might actually want to start opening up a conversation at work about the sustainability in the workplace. You might want to create a special forum where that is discussed amongst work colleagues. So it becomes the main thing on the agenda. And you're sure, in a way, I think then, that people are going to be looking at it in terms of what they can do. They're not instantly going to be feeling criticized. And another example might be with your family. If your favorite uncle has just announced that he's going to fly the entire family to Goa to celebrate his 60th birthday, if you say, I don't think I'm going to go because I've stopped flying, it's not going to go down very well. So you need to create the situation where you start to talk about your own decisions. So you might decide to say to somebody who you feel closest to in the family, I just want to talk about some of the things that have been interesting me, troubling me recently, because I've taken some quite big decisions about how I'm changing my life. So you introduce it as a personal subject, personal to you. And I think when you do that, you're more likely to get a positive response, because people will be interested in the fact that it's you doing it, that you're not telling them what they should do at this point. So that's certainly a part of it, I think, is choosing your moments, choosing your opportunities, trying to create the opportunities that you want.
Right. I think that's really important, to be able to say, well, this is what I'm feeling about this, and this is what I'm doing about it, without saying, you shouldn't do this and you shouldn't do that.
I think that's really essential. I think the moment that you start to use those words, should, shouldn't, ought, oughtn't, you set yourself up as a moral authority, and you become a persecutor to other people. You remind them of everybody else in their life who ever said, you shouldn't do that. Every teacher, every parent, every boss who told you what to do, you're suddenly in those shoes. And so you create what we might call a parent-child conversation, where you're the authoritarian parent and they're the child. And sometimes people will also put you into that position. They will take on the role of the rebellious teenager, and they will put you in that position, even if you've not been trying to take it up. And so I think being able to spot these sorts of dynamics in conversations can be very, very important. Trying to get into that adult conversation where you say what you think, they say what they think, you listen to each other. And that's another very important word, as I'm sure I've said to you before, Alex, is listen. You know, that when we listen to other people, we start to understand their life, their dilemma, why they're doing the things they do. We stop seeing them as a caricature and as a bad person. You know, you start to understand that your uncle who wants to take the whole family to Goa is doing this because he loves you all, because he'd really like to go there because it's been his dream since he was however old, and so on. And you start to have a conversation that's a real conversation between two people, and not a conversation between what I refer to as the projections, what the things we imagine about other people, which aren't necessarily true.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're having a carbon conversation of sorts right now with Ro Randall, the English psychotherapist, contributing her skills to the challenge of climate change. And Ro, it seems like the more we know about the climate problem, we're almost split in two. We worry about the future, and at the same time, we're maybe hoping to buy a new car or, as you say, planning air travel to meet up with family. Is it possible to be kind of a whole person even while this dichotomy, while the fossil fuel civilization rules?
I think one of the really important things to understand is that we're all creatures of conflict. We're made up of competing desires and impulses. I think you're spot on with what you said just then. You know, one part of myself, I really feel that I should be doing everything I can to make sure that dangerous climate change doesn't develop. With another part of myself, I want to do all the things that feel just ordinary in this society. I want to leave the lights blazing in my house. I want to turn the heating up. I want to buy some new clothes. I want to do those home renovations. I'd like a big new car. I'd like to fly and see my relatives in the States. All of these things are also going on. And I'm drawn into social and political systems, which make those things easy. So it's not surprising, I think, that people find themselves full of conflicts about what their values are, what they feel they should be doing, what they want to do, and full of conflicts because maybe they're doing stuff, but other people aren't. And so I think to recognize that we are all full of conflict, and that's a normal situation. We can't all be kind of 100% consistent the whole time. We would be robots if we were consistent like that. So we're negotiating conflict the whole time and facing difficult emotions around everything that we do.
Well, as Kermit the Frog says, it's not easy being green. So during the holiday season, I spent time talking with a geoscientist about our prospects. He was really pleased to talk with someone about climate change because scientists can feel shut in by what they know due to the things we've just been talking about. So, Ro Randall, do climate scientists need support as well?
I think they do. Over the last year, I've spent quite a bit of time talking with climate scientists about their experience of holding this very, very difficult knowledge. And in some ways, I think being part of a scientific community supports those people because you can bury yourself in your latest bit of research. You can retreat into the rationality that characterizes science. So there are kind of structural ways that people can protect themselves. But I think when it actually comes down to it, if you're a climate scientist, you're working with very, very frightening knowledge, and you're working in a situation where you know that most people in politics are not listening hard enough and are not actually taking the actions that need to be done. So I think that for people, anybody working in those situations, some kind of availability of support and conversation for how this makes you feel is very important. So I think if that doesn't happen, you get people burning out, and that really isn't something we want to see at the moment.
Right. Do you think telling people about the awful possibilities of climate change can actually hurt some sensitive people? Can we communicate the urgency and seriousness of our situation without making someone's mental health worse?
Some of the research into this is quite interesting because what it shows is that when you shock people with terrible images and frightening tales, you get an immediate reaction of, my God, this is dreadful, I must do something, but it doesn't last. And I think that this is because what happens is that when you shock somebody like that, you create a situation where it's essential that they put back their defenses, because we can't tolerate that level of anxiety for very long. And so people start to reconstruct a world where they don't have to have that kind of knowledge front of mind. And I think the dilemma is that if you tell people, well, it's not so bad and there's lots of nice little easy things you can do, you don't actually get people on board to really do what is necessary. And so I think what we have to do is to create in all kinds of levels of society what I refer to as containment or safe spaces, which is the situation where it's possible to face something really difficult, but feel that things aren't going to completely fall apart if you do. So this is very much what we try to do in the Carbon Conversations groups. We're saying, yes, this is actually very, very serious, but we can face this together. There is stuff we can do. There is stuff we can do individually and collectively and politically, and we can be part of a movement that's trying to do something, and we can get strength from that. And so I think it's about how you tell people bad news, really.
Well, I have to watch that on this radio show, but sometimes you just have to say it as it is and hope that people can deal with it. Now, do you think there's a particular kind of personality who's more likely to accept the science ahead of most people around them? Why do some people get the big picture while others seem immune or closed off?
Now, that's I mean, I think that's a tremendously interesting question, because I think when you look internationally at acceptance of climate change, you find a different picture in different countries. So you find higher levels of acceptance in some of the European countries like Germany and Scandinavia than you do in parts of the United States. And it's as if climate change has become associated for some people with other things which they don't like, or has become, you know, attached to particular political agendas, rather than being seen as a problem which affects all of us, whatever political solution we might want to take to it. And I think that then produces psychological reactions that some of us, I suppose all of us in a way, we're all able to hold things in different compartments in our minds. And psychologists refer to this as a process of disavowal. We know a piece of bad news with one bit of our mind, and we don't know it with another. And this lets us kind of carry on as normal. And so I think that there are all kinds of ways in which at the moment, for some people use that defensive strategy much, much, much more than others do, to try to pretend to ourselves that we're not really involved. And in some ways, I think the more serious form of this is not the one, the big one, where we, you know, the people who actually say, no, climate change isn't happening. It's all the rest of us who say, yeah, I know climate change is happening, but I don't really think it's anything much to do with me, or I know it's happening, but I hope the government will sort it out, or I know it's happening, but I don't think there's anything I can do. Those of us who sort of make these kind of rationalizations of why we can carry on just as we are.
Do you think in carbon conversation groups there are more women than men? And if so, why, and what does that mean?
There are more women than men who come to carbon conversations groups. This is true. I've been fascinated by this. I don't have an answer. Some of the answers that I come up with are kind of cliches. You know, women are more willing to talk about how they feel. And yet I know loads of men who are very happy to talk about how they feel. So I'm not convinced it's that. Some people claim that, you know, women have a closer connection to nature. I don't really believe that. Lots of men are also gardeners and farmers and fishermen and are close to nature. So I don't know why this is. And I would love to hear other people's views about why this seems to be the case.
I sometimes wonder whether it's just the sort of solitary hunter lineage in our genes, you know, that in many animals we see that the mother and the children stay together while the male is off somewhere and appears now and then.
So we're going back to their early tribal origins. Maybe there is something to do with the fact that men in groups often tend to be doing active things together. You know, men get together to play sport or to go drinking. Women get together to chat. And maybe the carbon conversations groups do have perhaps a slightly gendered feel to them for some men. That could be an explanation. You know, maybe there is a bit of a kind of history of the influence of feminist consciousness raising groups in the way carbon conversation works. I'm not sure about why this is gendered.
Well, I'm looking forward to more men, you know, forming carbon conversation groups, if that's what it takes. Now, I'd like just to get to a thought experiment as we head towards the end of our time. If we move 10 years ahead, say to 2025, record hot years are the new normal. Storm surges have already hit major cities. The Arctic is being transformed. What's the next stage for thinking about climate change once it is really obvious? Where's the next mental place we need to be?
This takes us, doesn't it, into the arguments about mitigation and adaptation. And I think 10 years ago, it was very clear that all our conversations were about mitigation. They were about how we might prevent climate change or prevent the worst. And increasingly, we're seeing conversations start about adaptation. How are we going to cope with what's coming? And I think that the conversations that we need to see have to be about justice and equality, because what I think we see when we look at what's likely to happen, the worst things are likely to happen to the poorest people in the most deprived areas of the world. And I think we've seen that even where, you know, disasters have hit already. You see that they're always much worse in the less prosperous areas of the world. You know, if you look at anything comparable like earthquake protection in California, it's brilliant. In Turkey, it's not great. And I think this means that we have to try and create frameworks where we think globally about justice in relation to climate change.
Do you think the next generation will blame us, or will everyone be just too busy trying to cope and adapt?
It's horrible to think that you might be blamed, isn't it? I'm 65. I look back at what my generation have done with the world, and I don't feel good about it. I feel ashamed. And yet I think that as an individual, I did what I could. So I think that's a very hard question. I think it's very important that we keep a sense of connectedness to the generations before and the generations after, and respectful connections. That we try not to blame. We try to respect what we've inherited, and we try to prepare for those who come after us. Whether the generation that comes after us are going to say, you did okay, you did your best, or whether they're going to look and they're going to go, you idiots, why didn't you wake up sooner? Why didn't you act? I don't know.
I'm going with the you idiots answer, but, you know, to be honest, I haven't heard a lot about carbon conversations here in North America or in Australia, where they're so desperately needed. Is it coming? Has it already started?
Well, we have a young, wonderful young woman called Kat Laird in Alberta who is starting up carbon conversations. We're hoping that she's going to get something going. And there's a great organization in Australia called Psychology for a Safe Climate. Now, they're not actually doing carbon conversations, but they're talking about psychology and climate change. And, of course, that's also where the great Clive Hamilton hails from. So there are people in Australia who are talking about it. And so in Canada, a cat, she tweets as Carbon Conversations CA, I think. Anyway, there are people talking about it, but I think one of the difficulties about something like carbon conversations is in our books, the detailed information is very UK specific, and that all needs to be translated for Canada, Australia, America, if you're going to follow the exact model we follow. But I think that getting people together in small groups to talk about the issues that we face, the way we cope with it psychologically, the way we handle our sense of loss and guilt and anxiety about this, I think anybody who gets together and does that will be doing a great job.
Where will people get this new handbook in time for tomorrow?
If you go to the Carbon Conversations website, which is www.carbonconversations.org, you will find on there information about how to buy the book. You can also go to my website, which is rorandall.org, and on that site there's actually like a button you can press, and it will take you to a PayPal button and a price for Canada, and you can buy a copy.
I'm going to do it. Ro, thank you so much. It's always encouraging to talk with you.
Well, it's been great. It's been a great conversation, Alex. Thank you very much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
In 1983, Oceania's coal output reached 630 million tons. In 1976, coal output was 605 million tons, an increase of 4.1%.
Hey, would you like me to talk dirty? Of course, I'm talking about coal, the fossil fuel that can wreck Earth's climate for 50 generations. Unless, of course, we go extinct, along with most other mammals and species long before that. But hey, don't worry. American jobs are at stake. That's the message coming from the National Center for Policy Analysis, or NCPA. It's a tax-exempt organization that's been pumping out the big business message for over 30 years. These days, the NCPA gets big bucks from the Koch brothers, just part of a network of front groups we call the Fossil Octopus. The NCPA put out an alleged report, which turns out to be a couple of pages written by staffer Jacopo Zenti. Here's the first paragraph of their press release. Quote, "Increasing U.S. coal exports could be good for the U.S. economy, workers, and the environment, according to a new report by the National Center for Policy Analysis Research Associate Jacopo Zenti." Really? Coal is good for the environment? Zenti just used an online coal fact browser put out by the U.S. Government Energy Information Administration, the EIA. Since America brags it has the world's biggest coal reserves, capable of sinking us all, I went to the EIA to see who's buying the black poison. And that buyer's club is surprising. We like to think Europe is getting greener, and many countries there are adding renewable energy at a breakneck speed. In the meantime, though, some of them are buying record amounts of coal from the U.S. Take Germany. Despite shutting down nuclear reactors after the Fukushima meltdowns, Germany is still on track to achieve 40% of their energy from renewables by 2025. Renewables are now larger than the dirty brown lignite coal that German mines produce, and it's gaining on gas and hard black coal. While the German economy has grown 40% since 1990, electricity demand there has actually gone down. Even better, German emissions of carbon dioxide in 2014 hit their second lowest levels since 1990. The bad news, as the NCPA tells us, quote, "German imports of American coal doubled from 2010 to 2011 and could continue to rise as Germany shifts from nuclear energy production to coal by 2022. And the United Kingdom and the Netherlands were the two largest importers of American coal in 2012. And American coal exports to Britain were 73% higher in the first three quarters of 2012 than in 2011, end quote. Of course, the NCPA is bullish on exporting American coal. As they admit, coal burning in America has fallen from 50% of all electricity produced in the 1990s to about 40% now. Newer power plants in the U.S. are powered by gas, not coal, so they need to sell it overseas. Efforts to build new coal shipping ports in places like Washington State and Oregon have hit several snags, with some projects abandoned due to high environmental impacts. No worries, the big Wyoming coal pits have struck a deal to ship their climate-killing product through the Port of Vancouver in Canada. It's like the Keystone Pipeline in reverse. The biggest black dream is to sell more coal to China, which still runs about 70% of its expanding economy on coal. And there's always India, still very coal-dependent. Let me quote further from the NCPA press release. Yet Zenti says concerns over environmental detriment are misplaced. For example, restricting coal imports to China will not reduce its emissions from burning coal, says Zenti. Without American imports, China would simply look elsewhere or consume more of its own coal, which often comes from unsafe, less regulated, and environmentally damaging mines. The United States should take advantage of the global movement on coal, says Zenti. Restricting coal exports will not dissuade other countries from burning coal and will instead hurt the American economy and U.S. workers, end quote. Okay, now this is the classic drug dealer's argument. We know high school kids will try heroin. We might as well sell it to them, because if we don't, somebody else will. You see, worrying about wrecking the world's climate is foolish. Let's make some money here, boys. Although it's strange, I can't find any mention of climate change in this coal lover's press release. The lobbyists bribing Congress people to boost American coal exports by slashing environmental regulations, some even want to get rid of the EPA altogether, they're actually building the trap door for an economic collapse. Take a look at Canada right now. The Canadian government built their holier-than-thou economic hopes on expensive oil from the tar sands. Now that is collapsing with cheap oil prices. Without those oil royalties, Alberta's provincial budget is in the toilet, along with the Canadian federal government. The Canadian dollar has collapsed, losing more than 20% of its value in just a few months. All that infrastructure and all that public spending is in doubt. Now let's fast forward just a few short years as people all over the world demand action to save what is left of the climate. Coal will be the first shoved overboard from that sinking ship. The railways, the ports, the city budgets, and state budgets built on coal will crash. While Germany and even China are building towards a renewable future, America seems hell-bent to stay on the horse and buggy age of unburnable fossil fuels, and that won't end well. So no, more coal exports are not good for the economy, and certainly not good for the environment. Some people don't mind a big lie, as long as it keeps today's profits coming in. I'm Alex Smith.
Coal. It's the fuel that powers our way of life.
Nobody tells you about coal like this guy, Robert Kennedy Jr. The world may try to forget what he told Real News back in 2008, but my hard drive never forgets, and YouTube remembers.
Is there such thing as clean coal?
No, there's no such thing as clean coal. There's theoretically, you can clean up parts of the coal process. But coal is dirty and destructive in every aspect of its production and its burning. And we have much cheaper forms of energy. Coal is only cheap if you ignore all the externalities, if you ignore the fact that today in 19 states it's now unsafe to eat any freshwater fish because of mercury contamination from coal plants. Mm-hmm. In 49 states, at least some of the fish are unsafe to eat. What is the cost of that to the public? What is the cost of the million asthma attacks that ozone and particulates from coal plants cause every year? A million lost work days, 60,000 deaths a year from coal-burning power plants from bad air. The acid rain, which has destroyed the forest cover on the high peaks of the Appalachian from Georgia to northern Quebec, that has acidified one-fifth of the lakes in the Adirondacks. Those are all parts of the cost of coal, plus the carbon that's coming from the coal. And, of course, there's all these government subsidized programs to try to sequester the carbon, but it's not going to work. And it's why should we be subsidizing, but giving more subsidies to one of the most highly subsidized industries in the world? Also, you know, probably the highest cost of coal is the destruction of the Appalachian Mountains, which are never going to come back. These are the most biologically diverse ecosystems in the world, and it's not going to come back.
There's a large advocacy organization here. There's a large lobby organization for clean coal. It's a conglomeration of all the coal industries that put their money behind it, and they have advertising, they have people on the ground, they've been in all the big primary states. They're fighting a battle to convince people that coal is necessary if we're going to be dependent on our own energy.
It's a lie. We have much cheaper energy sources in this country that are much less environmentally damaging, that are going to give us clean. We have the best solar energy. We have enough solar in 19% of the most barren desert lands in the Pacific Southwest to supply all of the energy needs in our country, even if every American owned an electric car. The Midwest, the Saudi Arabia of wind, if we invested in a fraction of the money that we've invested in subsidies to coal, in wind power, in extending our transmission lines to capture the wind in Montana, North Dakota, and Texas, we could supply all of our electric needs in this country from wind. So, do wind storage. We have the storage technology today. We have all the technological answers beat. We know how to do it. The myth is clean, that there's such a thing as clean coal, and it doesn't exist.
You said earlier today that we let the tobacco companies convince us for five decades that cigarettes were good for the American people, that companies have that power and lobbyists have that power. How do we prevent the coal industry convincing us that coal is not bad for the environment and that it's a good alternative to, you know, it's a good choice for our energy?
Well, you know, these are what I call the incumbents, oil and coal and nuclear energy. They've been able to use their political power, the huge amounts of money that they have to capture the political process. They put hundreds of millions of dollars into basically making half of Congress their indentured servants on Capitol Hill. They have a gigantic lobbying effort, which if you walk two blocks here, you'll see. You know, you'll see all these clean coal advertisements. And it's hard to go up against that. But that's what we have to do if we're going to take back our country. And now we have allies because there is a clean tech industry out there that can provide energy a lot cheaper than coal and a lot cheaper than oil. And so we have not just a bunch of environmentalists, but we have who can be marginalized as, you know, fringe characters. But there are people from blue chip companies, from Fortune 500 companies, and from green tech venture firms. And now 10% of the venture capital in this country is now going to green tech. That's going to create a big economic interest in this country that is going to start fighting back against this myth of clean coal, of course.
That was Robert Kennedy Jr. speaking to Matt Pilevsky of Real News on 26th of August, 2008. Find a link to that YouTube interview in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. And don't forget therealnews.com.
Radio EcoShock.
The time has come. I've got to run. Thanks for listening to Radio EcoShock, and thank you for caring about your world. I'm Alex Smith. Tune in again next week.